Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour for our 110th episode of the VFX Show. And this week we're going to be looking at The Social Network, which is a film I'm really excited to be talking about. We have a few regular hosts back, so we're really glad to have a pretty impressive team of experts from all corners of the visual effects and, actually, I must add, general community that were involved in this kind of technology. And we're going to start with Mark Christensen, whose idea it was to do The Social Network. Mark, how are you?
Great.
So, Mark, before we go any further, people might be wondering why The Social Network, but in fact, there's a stellar number of visual effects shots in this, isn't there?
Yeah, there are about 1,000, apparently, and about 980 of them are invisible.
Okay. And Mark will tell you which ones weren't invisible that caused him to suggest we actually do the show. Also joined from New York, I believe, is Jason Diamond.
Yeah, howdy do, everyone.
And then south of there, I believe in Florida, is Kanan Flowers. How are you, Kanan?
I'm excellent, and I am, in fact, south of New York in lovely Boca Raton, Florida.
Excellent. Now, I should point out at this point that we obviously often see Kanan's opinion both as an independent filmmaker and as an editor, but I'm actually going to be referring to him a bit as our technical programming expert this week as well, because for those of you that don't know, he has a very strong background in security programming, and I like to refer to it as the big H hacking. You've been into programming and stuff for years, right?
That's true. And in fact, ironically, I am in lovely Boca Raton hanging out with the creator of a programming language called New Lisp. It's the most popular Lisp out there. And I just spoke at a conference yesterday on my birthday called Hacker Halted.
Well, for a start, let's say happy birthday.
Yeah.
Happy birthday. Oh, thank you.
Hacker Halted because you're stopping hackers, or Hacker Halted because you're not? Because you sort of almost sit on both sides of that fence.
I do. As you know, I don't like to use the word hacker in a negative way. I think that there other ways to do that. But Hacker Halted because it prevents the bad guys from getting into the network.
Okay. So now the culture that is The Social Network is the culture of the foundation, of course, of Facebook. But there are many aspects of this that are of great interest because, I mean, we've all lived it, right? I mean, I remember when, for example, Napster came out and then went away. And from there on, obviously, the last, 10 years or less has been very vivid in all of our memories. So we've all got interesting perspectives on this. We're obviously going to talk a little bit about the film and its social context and then move on to the visual effects, which includes some really, really interesting things. And, of course, the ones that Mark caused us to do the show about, which we'll come to later. So let's start with our general review as we do before we go on to the specifics of the visual effects work. And Jason, I'm going to start with you. I don't know what your background is in terms of Facebook. I know that you're under the age of 40, so you must be on it.
I'm 39. I'm right at the cusp there.
So what do you think of the film?
I actually really liked it, and I thought Aaron Sorkin's script was amazing. It was tight, and it's really hard to describe because it was just so on it. Like I didn't really find any extraneous weight in the film or the dialogue. There wasn't really a lot of scenes I thought were unnecessary. It was only 2 hours long, which is, I think, pretty good length for this kind of film. And it had a lot of information I didn't know. Obviously, there's a lot of extrapolation in the film, but I enjoyed it.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that Sorkin, who, I mean, I just couldn't be a bigger fan of his work. I'm a massive West Wing fan. But he's getting very high billing for a writer. I mean, a writer almost equally up there with Fincher, who in his own right is a somewhat of a, you know, celebrity type director. And you could open a film just on the basis of it being a Fincher film. And yet we're seeing Sorkin's name almost as much as I'm seeing Fincher's name. Is that the same for you, Mark?
Are you saying that Sorkin wouldn't open a film?
No, I'm just saying that we're seeing an unusual, publicity nod to the writer that we wouldn't normally see, given that the director themselves is very well known, and so there's nearly no reason that you have to do that to pull an audience.
Yeah, I just think Aaron Sorkin it's one more big name to put up there that probably will get some people in there to see it.
It does pull a different audience, too.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? So So, Kanan, this was a thing that was said before the film came out, which is, will anyone but sort of young males be interested to see this film? Do you have an opinion on that from an independent filmmaker's point of view first?
Well, I would hope that a lot more people would try and see this film. I mean, I do agree with everyone. I think it's good. I've actually seen it twice, and I enjoyed it immensely both times. The second time I caught a lot more than I did the first time. Yeah, I would hope that a lot more people would see it. It's unfortunate to me, and we can talk a lot more about this, but you know, the budget for this film, in my mind, was very small for this type of film. But it also did not fare very well at the box office. I mean, it did okay. It didn't do fantastic.
I must admit, I'm not aware of what the box office receipts are for The Social Network. I got the impression that it was going rather well, but that's not the case.
Last I checked, which was about 48 hours ago, 36 hours ago maybe, it was $52 million is what it had made, which is not much.
The budget was 50, so adding right, marketing the budget was 50. And all that, adding probably another 50 for marketing and all that other stuff, they got a little ways to go.
Well, that and the fact that we know that American box office accounts for about 8 to 10% of the total revenue that you're going to get from a film. So, you know, there's at least $400 million out there if they can get $50 million at the U.S. box office by the time they do all the other things that they do.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, those Mark Zuckerberg action figures are going to be amazing.
Hey, for me, one of the really huge things, obviously you guys would all have guessed this, but those listening may not, is this was shot on the Red Mysterium X. So this was the yep. MX chip in the Red. Obviously, Jason Diamond, that's also a big factor for you.
Yep.
So can I sort of start there before I even hit the visual effects and say, what do we think of the look of it, and what do we think of the sort of dynamic range and the basic, the feeling of the quality of the cinematography?
I would say that I thought the dynamic range felt a little limited. It felt a little squeezed to me, even though I know they went for a low light look, and reading through all the materials and why not, they intentionally lit low instead of lighting high and bringing down in the grade. But I don't know, it seemed a little like didn't seem like as much latitude in the image as I know can be there. Now, granted, it was, you know, there was no experience with the chip at the time. It was prototype cameras or prototype sensors. So we've all had a lot more time to play with them than they did. I think it looked good.
So let's put that in some context with these other works. So Zodiac was shot on the Viper, and that yep. was pretty interesting. And I thought it looked magnificent. I discovered after I'd seen it, because I saw a press screening of Zodiac, and I was stunned at how good it looked for the Viper. They actually spent like six digits worth of basically, well, I'm going to say cleanup, but it's a digital signal processing cleanup, not a manual cleanup, to get that Zodiac footage looking so good. But I still thought it looked excellent. Obviously, he shot Benjamin Button with as well as 35 in HD video. So it's not as if Fincher's team isn't comfortable with digital.
I
actually thought it looked good. I mean, I thought it looked really good. I think that the darks were going to be pushing it for any camera, but at no point did I look at it and come out of the film and go, ah, they've gone for a 360-degree shutter, or no point did I come
oh,
and go,
absolutely oh, not, no.
Or it's looking digital or video-y or even reddish. There are sometimes I see films and I actually think they look a bit like I can pick them as being very reddish. But I quite happily watched this film and loved it, but didn't really – I had to almost remind myself that I was looking at red footage because I got so engrossed in the story. And I particularly liked the rowing sequences and stuff, which obviously had visual effects on top. But nevertheless, yeah. Those exterior sequences stacked up really, really well. Mark Christensen, interestingly, when they did the visual effects for this, they used blue screen on the – car interior. So at the very beginning of the film, he's with his girlfriend in the car and stuff. But those out the window shots, which I normally use to rate the film, I normally recommend people to use blue screen. Obviously, it meant to be at night, so they shot blue screen. But did any of the keying in that car type stuff bug you?
I didn't catch anything that bugged me about it, and I've gone around on these with you before on the show.
Yeah, and I think it held up really well. And the weakest point for the Red camera, the reason I bring it up, should be shooting blue screen, because blue is its least sensitive channel and tends to mark up a bit. Now, I spoke, luckily, to the guys at Lola this morning, actually, for an article on FX Guide, and they were saying that it was very dark, and they really welcomed the response out of the blacks and said that they had a big noticeable difference between the footage that they were working with for stuff we'll come into later in the show on the MX versus the M chip. Cannon, what was your opinion on the just the look of this Red footage?
Well, I thought it looked really fantastic. I mean, it's no secret I'm a huge fan of Fincher, so just about everything he's done I've loved immensely and deeply and profoundly. I mean, I thought that the Benjamin Button was shot mostly on a Sony F23, if I recall.
Yeah, I think
correctly.
So, yeah.
And that footage to me seemed a lot more crisp and a lot just visually it had a lot more depth to it. But the story that is being told in this particular film, I thought, lent itself very well to the less vibrant footage, and so I thought it worked out really well. And I heard somewhere, I don't know if it was a rumor, but I heard somewhere that actually the two cameras that were used to shoot this film were actually Steven Soderbergh loaned them to Fincher, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I heard that as well. And also another two were custom built by Red in very, very lightweight bodies, so they could use them for the rowing sequences.
Yeah, carbon fiber.
Mm. I don't know,
can we get one of those?
Have any of you guys had much experience with that kind of eight-sculling rowing?
No.
I went to a military academy where it was compulsory, so if nobody else is willing to jump in, I will. the boats that certainly at my school were rowing in were so high performance that literally they would only go one season and they would move to the B crew, and the third season they'd be replaced. And so they are ultra lightweight, incredibly... these are not your sort of typical rowboats. And so the idea of producing a lightweight camera, you know, I'm stunned that even a lightweight camera would have worked in that setup. But having said that, I mean, I think they got them down to 6 pounds without the lenses. So I don't know what the lenses were. Does anyone know what the lenses were when they were shooting the rowing stuff? But I'm guessing they might have to. Stills lenses?
I don't know. The only thing I read, I didn't see anything about that sequence, but the ASC article said that they used master primes on the whole film, but
yeah,
those are pretty heavy.
I'm willing to bet that they would have gone for something other than master primes for that rowing sequence, because if you go into the trouble of going for such a cut down Red camera, you would happily shoot, I'm sure, with something like a Canon lens. Which brings us to the first of our visual effects sequences, which is A52 and the rowing sequence. So let's discuss that because we're here. I adore any film that is willing to do some interesting cinematic things in a straight narrative story. So as you guys know, as we proved conclusively with some films recently here on the VFX show, I don't tend to like full fantasy kind of break from reality films. But that being said, if you are in a narrative drama or comedy and then you can do something really interesting with the cinematography that helps the story, I'm first in line. And I loved the Cambridge rowing sequence. So that had the... what we typically talk about as being like the diorama effect, by having a split focus, it made what should be all in focus have a very shallow depth of field, especially from big, high, and wide shots. And that was done in post-production. Jason, what did you think of that?
I had heard about the swing tilt section. I didn't know where it was prior, so I was sort of keeping an eye out for it. I didn't mind it. Excuse me. I liked... The very first high wide had that classic, you know, toy boat style, which I liked. But all the ones after that felt very – it worked stylistically, but they felt more processed in terms of not image quality, but the it didn't give as much of a swing tilt look as it did just like a sort of a custom depth of field blur effect, I thought. Maybe like 80% of them were that, and 20% of them felt like a real straight-up lensed swing tilt, which I know they were all post, but...
So, Cannon, do we care if it looked like a sort of swing tilt lens or just looked cool? Does it make any difference, do you think?
No, I mean, I thought the film looked great, and I did notice it wasn't just in the rowing scene. I mean, there's a fair amount of this film where you're taking a look at it and you get this incredibly shallow depth of field. I wonder sometimes if they didn't just, you know, find a 1 millimeter point right square between the eyes of the person who was in focus and then just blur the hell out of the rest of it. Because some of the depth of field in the rowing scene, in the scene with Sean Parker with the girl from Stanford, I mean, some of it is completely out of hand. I mean,
out of hand, you mean creatively, or out of hand like you didn't like it in the context of the film?
No, I think it's credible. I mean, it looks like a the kind of depth of field that I used to get on my Canon. I had a 50 millimeter fixed focal length lens on that, and if I shot that just right, I got this amazing depth of field, and much of the film felt like that. It was just, it was pretty extreme, I think.
I read that they shot the Master Primes wide open at 1.3 as much as possible and just stacked up the NDs. So that'll do it.
Mark, for somebody that's not done this kind of stuff, it's relatively easy, obviously, to do some kind of a high quality rack defocus blurring, but by the same token, you do have to be careful that anything that's in the foreground that's excluded by the blur, by the nature of being in the foreground, its edges look good to the background. Do you think this sequence worked?
Yeah, talking about the boat sequence, what I loved about it is what it does for the story, making fun, I think, of the Winklevoss twins by making their big event, their big boat race, look like this little
toy race.
Kiddie pool event. Yeah, toy race.
Well, that and the last line of the film about them coming sixth in the Olympics seem to be like a really good editorial
nice
comment.
Punching the balls right there at the end, yeah. And those ridiculous Harvard coats they're wearing at the ceremony afterward when they get bypassed by
there's nothing wrong with Harvard. My wife done stuff at Harvard Law School. I stand up for Harvard completely. But you can have a go at the twins, but that's okay. Yes, go on.
I was only talking about the coats, Mike.
Okay, all right. I'm just saying, I'm not going to be sleeping on the sofa if you...
As for the depth of field, I might have been the only person in the cinema I was in to feel this way, but it had me really on edge. There were scenes where I felt like the featured character, and in particular the Zuckerberg character, was out. And I couldn't find what was meant to be in focus. And I'm not saying they misshot it. In fact, I started to suspect that maybe the projector where I was seeing it was just a hair out, because there were certainly plenty of shots where I wasn't sitting there going, okay, they misfocused this projector. But really, there were shots where the twins are sitting side by side. One of them's in, the other one's out. Like, it was really shallow depth of field in this baby.
Yeah, I mean, I loved the rowing scene. I loved the audio change. I loved that it gave us a good sort of break in the film editorially, and genuinely, as I said, I like it when somebody mixes it up a bit. As for the other shallow depth of field stuff, there was a couple of shots that I thought that the focus was slightly off, but instead of thinking it was a projector, I thought it was sort of literally carefully done by the filmmakers to, because it was kind of unsettling in some places as to how the, and I felt that was in sync with, now it could just be that I'm such a, with Kanan, such a Fincher fan that I'll give him credit even for being out of focus deliberately.
No, but I think you might be right. I mean, it is remarkable that it was Zuckerberg that usually, that I was going, why can't I see him clearly? And he was off in the shadows, not, you know, kind of a little further out in frame than a lot of the rest of the characters. So
right.
Yeah,
I think that was a conscious choice. I think there are many, many times when the Zuckerberg character was meant to be portrayed as in the background and not part of the scene.
Whereas that's what I think as well. Yeah.
Then you go to like the deposition, he is in razor sharp, ridiculous focus when he's speaking in the deposition. Even though he makes statements like, you know, you have the minimum of my attention.
Which I've got to say, I thought was one of the best lines that character delivered in the film. I mean, that was just, because at some point you had to believe, it's based on a true story, but I wanted to believe that he had a keen intellect and was bright, and I wanted that to be portrayed on the screen. And whether you thought he had the social skills or not, well, let me ask you. Okay, so I should clear the decks here a second. Kanan, what's our opinion of this from a reality point of view? Like, is this matching your perception of the reality from watching from, you know, your position in life, or is this like got no bearing on reality?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question because I obviously lived and breathed Silicon Valley and raised a bunch of money and started companies. And I actually know both Sean Fanning and Sean Parker. I'm actually friends with them on Facebook. Hi, guys. And actually, I'm friends on Facebook, too, with many of the investors who were involved in this. And, while I think a lot of it was a bit larger than life, obviously, some of the things didn't happen. You can go online and you can look at the D8, the Walt Mossberg D8 interview with Zuckerberg, and you can get an idea of his personality, and you can see he is that kind of super bright, razor sharp, somewhat fidgety, a bit eccentric, slightly awkward guy that they portrayed, and I thought that was a good job. It's also, as you know, the screenplay is based on a book by Ben Mezrich, who... he wrote a book called The Accidental Billionaires, but he's written other books before that. He wrote books about, you know, the guys in Vegas who played 21, the guys from Harvard. And
love that book.
And so you get a – yeah, exactly. So you get a sense that, you know, this is not a speaking of the author in this case, this is not a guy who messes around and completely fabricates information. I mean, he's a very well-respected journalist and a well-respected writer who writes about things that actually happened from a very deep inside perspective. In fact, there's a – I can't remember who they said it was in the film, but my understanding was in real life it was Chrysalis who at one point Zuckerberg went in his pajamas and said, hey, by the way, Sean Parker says – and I remember hearing about that when I was in San Francisco. I remember hearing a couple of my venture capital friends saying, you will not believe what happened the other day.
So can I ask you, well, firstly, I think we should flag that when the book was being written, the screenplay was being written. So in fact, Sorkin, while he's adapting a book for the screen, in fact, did his own research. So there needs to be both some credit and some blame at Sorkin's feet directly. And I personally think it's more in the credit than the blame category because he only had, I think, a 12-page synopsis of the film when he signed on to do it. And so, in fact, he did a lot of his own research. And some of you may have seen there's been some criticism of the portrayal of female characters in this, and he's actually defended that and pointed out a lot of the where he's amalgamated characters and where he hasn't in putting the screenplay together. And I think, you know, there'd be nothing greater than having Sorkin actively doing his own research. But I think you could put Sorkin in the same category as you did the author as to somebody that, you know, you could credibly say doesn't muck around and doesn't do these things lightly.
I would agree with that. I mean, I've seen Studio 60 and I've seen Sports Night, and, you know, the guy knows what he's doing. There's a really funny scene, just a little aside of what I think may be trivia. There's a scene where they're in the deposition and they're talking about Harvard and, you know, they're saying Nobel laureates and a famous actor and all of this stuff. You know who the famous actor was, right?
Natalie Portman.
There you go.
Yeah, she went to Harvard.
Yeah, she went to Harvard and, you know, she actually was worked with Sorkin on the film to provide background information about what it was like at Harvard during that time. Cause she was there from 99 to 2003.
She's great. We shot with her in Sydney when we were doing a commercial for her for, I think, Lux. Can I ask you about Sean Parker? Because this has got nothing to do with VFX, but I promise I'll get back on VFX right after this. But the film really left you hanging a little as to how Sean Parker moved from being so influential to just having 7%. It was like almost an afterthought at the end of it. Is there another film in that story, do you think, or is that all there is to know?
Briefly, like 7% for a guy who was president of a company that became that big and took on that much money is actually held a lot of stock. I mean, it's a great deal of stock for someone who came in at the time he did and provided the level of influence he did. And, you know, Sean got in trouble for drugs and all kinds of other things. And, you know, they were worried that it would make Facebook look bad. And so they extricated him from the situation, much as many companies have done. You know, David Worthen from Ask Jeeves was made an Ask Jeeves fellow before the company went public to get Ask Jeeves away from some of the possible scandalous things that were happening. And so, you know, this is a pretty common thing that happens. But Parker has gone on to do a couple of really cool companies, one of which is a angel or venture investment firm that is basically six founders who only invest in other founders. I think it's called Founders for Founders or something like that. And so he's done quite well. And if you get a chance, you should go to Google Videos and search for Sean Parker. He has some amazing presentations about what it means to be in a social world and what it means to develop companies and, you know, in the market of today. And I mean, he's an incredibly, incredibly intelligent person who just happens to
A lot of very intelligent people in this film. But let me ask Jason, because I don't want to ask you as you're friends with these guys. Jason, do you think was any character in this film that the filmmakers had the audience aligned with in terms of rooting for that character?
I mean, I felt sort of equally interested in all the characters, because or all the main characters at least, because I think they gave each person their slot in their influence and how everything came together. And the way that I have to call out as an editor, the editing in this film was amazing. And the way that they would cut even just like what you would read as straight dialogue between the two depositions and the real world, or the what you could consider past recreation or not, the way that they cut between all three timelines to deliver a sort of forward-moving narrative, I thought was expertly executed.
Oh, and I couldn't agree more. I think that was just superb.
So given that framework, I think they deftly, again, for me, because I didn't have a huge background on Zuckerberg or Parker. I knew more about Sean Fanning than Parker, and certainly not any of the Winklevosses or even his buddy that ended up getting screwed out of 34%. So, but I felt like by the end of the movie, I knew who each character was, how I felt about them, and why I felt that way about them, which I think goes a long way to the filmmaking, but the editing and the script, I think, really nail that down.
Well, I don't know if it's done anything for the reputation of the real-life characters, but it's certainly done a lot for the reputation of Justin Timberlake, in my opinion, because I thought he was excellent as Sean Parker. And I agree, like, the acting is great. Okay, so let's swing on to the visual effects. And, Mark, I've been saving you for this, so let's you and I hit it hard. And the one that I think is probably most understood, though, was a heap of window replacements and stuff, and we'll discuss some of those later, and the fact they couldn't shoot at Harvard. But the big one is the faces of the twins and how that was done. So do you want to start outlining how that was done? And I'll jump in as I – because I've learned a bit from the Lola guys this morning, as I said.
Well, and actually, Mike, I've heard you detail this technology in great depth before, so I think you're probably the guy. But yes, I think the basics are that having pulled off Benjamin Button, they had in mind to reach back into the bag of tricks of replacing a character's head, or face in this case, and rather than fabricating it via CG, like with Benjamin, they had the actor that he wanted, Armie Hammer, to be one of the Winklevi, and then a stand-in, same size, I think even the same like hairstyle maybe, so that it was really just the face that was being replaced, to stand in for the other one. And then they, instead of doing the CG approach, they did another related perhaps approach in terms of where it comes from, of shooting the face in very high definition with a bunch of red cameras so that they could replace it with the lighting of the scene.
Yeah. And before we get into the specifics of that, and obviously there's a whole article over at FX Guide on that, did you think it worked?
Absolutely. I wasn't distracted by it at all. I bought it, pretty much.
Pretty much or
yeah,
fully?
No, I bought it.
I mean, I bought it. Does anyone here have any shots of the... Because American Cinematography reports it was 15, it's actually 20 major face replacements. Does anyone have any of those that they thought were bad?
No, and I'm a twin. And right. I bought it. And I went with my twin, and we both bought it. But what's amazing, and I think we touched on this a little bit on the moon episode, is that it feels like way more than 20 because of the over the shoulders and the way that they do it. Like, you're like, 20? There's only 20 in the whole film?
20 face replacements. There's quite a lot of split
screens.
That's what I mean. And,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And yeah, okay.
But it just, it feels like, you know, they're all over the place.
Kanan?
Right. Well, I saw the film twice, and so I have the fortune of knowing exactly what you're talking about, Jason. The first time I saw it, I did not know. I went in with nothing. I read nothing about it. I just wanted to see the film. So I saw it, and then I read a bunch of stuff about it, you know, seeing that they had done this face replacement and everything. And so the second time I saw the film, I was looking for it, and I realized there's a tremendous, and I mean tremendous amount of camera trickery going on. Where exactly right. There's one of them is turned. It's an over the shoulder. You know, one of them is in frame. The other one's slightly out of frame. I mean, this happens scene after scene after scene. So they don't have to do this face replacement. And I know that the two people who played the twins, Hammer and Pence was the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
They went to twin training camp for 10 weeks, or 10 months rather, to try and make sure that their movements were exact with one another. So one of the things I think that makes this believable isn't just the CG, of which, you know, there were four reds and Buju and PF Track and Flame and Maya and all this stuff going on, but it's the fact that these guys move in sync with one another. And you know, when you're just replacing the head, right, when you have two people who spent, you know, 10 months trying to look exactly like one another, going to a kind of boot camp and working out so that their bodies were shaped fundamentally the same way, and then learning to mimic twin each other's movements, I think, you know, that goes as far as the CG does.
So, Mark, let's walk through the how they did the CG in a little more detail, though I'm paraphrasing an article over on FX Guide, so if you want to get the full details, please, I honestly recommend reading the Lola article. But basically, what you want to do is you want to have, we have a choice, I guess. In Benjamin Button, they did a digital head, which was placed where the digital actor needed to be on the body normally of a real actor. But it's like you take off the head, you put a new one on. This wasn't that. As you said, it was face replacement. So the best way to describe it, in fact, this is Fincher's term apparently, it's a hockey mask. It's the section around the face inside the hairline and normally excluding the ears. That's going to be digitally replaced and have a new face put in there. And as you said, they film an actor there with some dots on his face walking around. That gives the eye line for every other character. And, of course, the body that Kanan so correctly pointed out accurately feels like the body of a twin. And then they analyze that. Now, this is what I thought was really interesting, guys. They analyze this without the use of HDRs because for some reason, apparently, David Fincher, who I just think is brilliant, doesn't like HDRs, and so they didn't do HDRs on set, which I found stunning. So they analyzed the stock footage, well, not so, what do you call it, the publicity shot, the you know, general shots of the room to know what the dimensions were like, but then they just analyzed the lighting in it to reproduce the lighting that you would need on a dummy CG head to match the one that was there. And they used, I think somebody said Buju and PF Track, though it was primarily PF Track. And then they would put in the actor's head of the same guy you're trying to replace. So we're no longer talking about the new face, well, I mean the old one. So in this case, if it was, well, let's use the characters' names, Cameron and Tyler. So if you're trying to replace Tyler's face, then you are putting Tyler's head back on Tyler's body again to see if your digital version of Tyler's head matches your actual version of Tyler's head. Same faces, no special effects, but we just want to see if the lighting matches. But you're never going to use these computer lights. All you're using the computer lights for at this point is to learn what the lighting was like on the real Tyler on set. Then you take all that information and you use it to program effectively a concert lighting panel, like a DMX panel that you would use to control a rock concert, to be able to have lights go off and on in real time, in normal performance time, so that when you get the actor that was playing Cameron to now go onto a soundstage to do his twin double performance, his performance is given, he's delivering the lines, and the lights are changing around his head in the exact time that it was for Tyler on set. So Tyler, for example, let's say somebody walked, Tyler walks past a door, and that means there's suddenly a bit of more bright light on the right of his face. On set, you film Tyler, the actor, walking past the door, but he's got dots on his face. You then go into post-production, you try and work out where you'd put some 3D lights that would cause light to go on the side of Tyler's face, only so you can program a lighting panel to do that. Then you go into a studio and get the Cameron guy to sit down, and now you switch on your DMX, and in the 5 seconds that the shot lasted, halfway through, it turns on some lights at the side and turns them off again to simulate going past a doorway. And that's the computer graphics bit kind of done now, stage one. Throw away that lighting information, never use those lights again. You've now got a live-action recording of Cameron's head with some light flashing on the side of it. And you filmed that, as I think somebody said, with a bunch of reds. I think you said that, Mark, right? Was it four or eight?
Four is what it says.
Okay, and they're just sitting around him, right? And he is standing on a soundstage, and actually there's this, I think, and there's a projector projecting on a screen a red dot that he's using to follow his eye line. So that's the other thing you use the computer graphics for, to work out where he should be looking and generate that computer dot that you can re-project up on a screen so that he has something to look at, and that dot moves correctly during the five-second take. So if Tyler on set had moved his eye line from looking to the right to the left as he walked past the door, the dot moves from the right to the left to cause the Cameron on the soundstage to know where to look. Now you've filmed his head. You get rid of now the computer graphic Tyler head, put that to one side, and bring in the computer graphic version you've got of Cameron's head, and you now animate that head in 3D to have the same facial smile, wink, whatever, as the actor did in his performance on the soundstage when he was just sitting there alone. The reason for this is that you need his underlying sort of nose, mouth, everything to bend and move exactly the same as his performance, because you're going to reproject the performance back over that geometry. In other words, you're like texture mapping that geometry that you've just animated to smile with the live action that you got from the red cameras. The trick here is you're not trying to computer graphics do it. You're not trying to write a shader for skin and then subsurface scatter it and all that kind of crap. What you're doing is you're literally just taking the live action stuff and putting it back on that CG head, and now you take the what now looks like a very real CG head, albeit just over black, and stick it back on Tyler actor's body, and wherever, for example, Tyler's chin poked out from underneath that, you erase that carefully in flame, and wherever it gets near the hairline or anything else, you blend that. And then you spend the next, I don't know how many days, polishing it, color grading it, tweaking it so that it really, really sits in there. And so, in fact, the computer graphics you use twice, once to work out what the lighting would need to be to make sure that the actual lighting desk moved all its buttons correctly. And then secondly, you do it using PF Track so that you render that projected head so that it moves and matches the movements of the Tyler actor's head. And that's how you do it. Now, it may sound quite convoluted, and hopefully you guys struck with me with that. I know you guys, the hosts here, would understand this stuff really easily. But if you didn't understand it, that with diagrams is over at FX Guide. But I think what's really interesting about this is, A, they didn't use HDR. B, they didn't really use, because a lot of people suggested they use Paul Debevic's techniques. And to a certain extent, this is inspired by that, but quite different from it, in that it has no kind of rendering or even scanning stuff that Paul's team has done at ICT. And then finally, I think this is like a really valid approach that you could use moving forward on a bunch of different films. I mean, I think this is just a really valid way of achieving this effect. I could see this being reused a lot. I think this is the first time Lola's done it, but I think Lola right now is the number one place in the world to go to for human changes that are inside the realm of what you might consider moving between one person and another. I think Lola, obviously digital domain, but Lola is just brilliant at actually eye matching and sorting this stuff out. Because don't forget, for this to work, you had to have A, somebody be able to interpret the lighting of the original thing to get it right, and B, you had to have somebody sitting there doing the hand animation of Cameron's face before you reprojected Cameron's face over it to match up. And so far from being an automated process. This is really Lola's team showing the depth of Lola's talent, I reckon, because everybody here has to nail it. Because you know, I know what it's like. If this was even slightly out, like a little nod or whatever, it would just change the performance.
Absolutely. I think
right.
I think you could coin the term for them, practically digital.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's actually the if I was in Fincher's position, I would want to do it as practically as possible for just the reason. I don't want to worry about skin shaders and all that stuff. Use the real skin and just project it back on. I mean, it's not that simple, but I think it's the most elegant. Simple. Oh, yeah. It's the most elegant solution, I think, that's come up.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, you might be asking yourself, if you're listening to this, why didn't they just use Paul Debevec's movable light stage, which was already set up and functional and working, and it's one of those things where they could have actually used that to do the lighting. But the fact is that the Red has this rolling shutter, and Debevec's system is a light that does pulse modulation, and because of the Red's rolling shutter, if you know anything about how the rolling shutter works, if you don't keep the light, the LED frequency, right around 2800 to 3500 hertz, what you start getting is flickering in the image, which would be extremely visible on, obviously, on film. And so they had to do this because if they were going to shoot on the Red, this was the only choice. They could have used a different camera and used Debevec's lighting, but they used the Red.
Well, okay. I would say that they could have used the Red for the live-action plate, and they could have used a different camera for the head stuff. But I would suggest to you, not knowing, just speculating, that it was more that if he didn't want to do an HDR on set, I'm betting that he kind of got sick of the slowdown in the performance-based stuff due to the technical considerations of pulling off the fully digital head. Because if he doesn't even want someone to go in there and do an HDR, you'd have to do, you know, not just an HDR, but a succession of HDRs to pull off the Benjamin Button thing. And if you don't have to go that far, which you don't, because these guys, well, actually Fincher himself was the Lola guys credited Fincher as actually suggesting this is the way to go, and they just worked out how to refine it. So David Fincher said, look, here's a way we could do this, which is not going to be as onerous on set. This is my guess. I don't know this for a fact. And he's right. And in a piece that's so performance-based and doesn't require you to, you know, age a man backwards, which is virtually, you know, like just so hard that you couldn't have pulled it off with this particular technique, I think that to sound cliche, but I think he just went for the right tool for the job. I don't see any technical reason why he couldn't have done it the other way had he been a masochist and just not used something other than the Red for the facial capture stage. Does anyone see why that wouldn't work?
I was wondering that too.
I think he fell in love with the Red just like he fell in love with the Viper. I don't know this for a fact either, but you know, technically we do both live in San Francisco, as does Mark. So we have that sort of same spaceship mentality probably. I think he fell in love with the Red.
But there's nothing wrong with shooting with the Red. I'm just saying, why couldn't you shoot with the Red and do the visual effects work with a different camera? Like, why does it have to be the Red for? Because only the Red would only fail in your rolling shutter theory if it was used in the capture sequence during the fast light stage stuff, which is to say a bit of a specialist bit anyway, right?
But I guess you'd have to flip that upside down and say, what did they lose by not doing it that way?
Well, good point. And I think between the four of us, we haven't found a single fault with this in terms of on-screen. I mean, it doesn't feel like this is going to look bad. This doesn't feel like this is really good considering what they ... This just looks good, full stop.
Yeah, I think as I said and as everyone said, there's not a single scene where the what they refer to in the film and what I heard someone earlier say, the Winklevi. There's not a single scene where the Winklevi, you look at them and you say, okay, that is clearly two different people with some CG. I never felt that way.
Ken, coming from an editing point of view for a second, or anyone else jump in on this if you like, did anyone feel that the shots with the brothers were contrived to avoid having to do face shots? Because it seemed to me that I at no point felt the editing changed its rhythm or cadence when the twins were on set, it didn't feel like the twins caused us to suddenly have locked off shots or not have locked off shots, etc. Did you feel that?
I never felt that once. I felt like they shot the film and then that was their primary goal, is just to shoot a really good film. Yeah.
I actually thought about that while I was watching it, and I couldn't find a spot where you would want to shoot it any differently. Like the scenes with the Winklevoss twins, I never thought that you would like, oh well, you know, I bet they did this for like it was straight filmmaking. And you would assume that Fincher at this point is one of those guys that's like, I don't care, that's the shot I want, I'm not changing it, because you know what I mean, he assumes you can get it done. With the right amount of money, you get anything done, and he's already...
Okay, but I'm going to say that I actually think... So I know where you're going with that, but I actually think it's wrong. I actually think that Fincher's a guy who says, I know what I want to achieve here, so I can shoot it this way, but I know that if I push it too hard or too much, whatever, it could fall over, and I'm okay with that because I can work inside those confines without looking like I'm working inside those confines. Because there was there was no like 10-minute sequence of one of these characters on screen, 10 minutes, but you know what I mean, like 3 minutes, whatever it is, long sequence of the twins where you felt like it was a, pardon my French, fuck off shot, where it was just like, we're just showing off now. Like it felt to me like he was like, if we cut it like this and move it like this, then we'll be able to get away with these shots and we'll be cool, rather than those directors that go the other way and say, I'm making no compromise for the VFX, you guys just going to have to pull it together because I just want to just, you know, almost in your face give you a hard shot. I mean, Mark, wouldn't you agree? Like it felt to me like, because he understands the technology so well, that he actually knew what he could get away with and just then designed perfectly for it.
Well, yeah, the other key to that was not just green screening in the second guy for the most part, because you know, if you do that, this whole thing that we were talking about earlier about the twins and mirroring each other, and you know, I mean, twins even match each other's breathing. There's all these subtle levels at which twin, well, actually we have a twin with us who could tell us whether that's true or not, but that I think made the difference. Whereas you look at some of the other examples of twins in a movie, and there is a little bit of the uncanny valley that you fall into when they're kind of bobbing around and they don't seem to know each other is there. And that just wasn't the case here. And I would credit having a physical actor there as being part of that as well.
And Mike, I think you mistook my point, because I am actually agreeing with you by saying that I don't assume Fincher is going to do some insane shot that for no reason. So what I meant was that he understood that, given the confines of the way he knew he wanted to put the film together, that he didn't feel like he needed to compromise the shots. He could get the shots he wanted, because you're not going to have a 3-minute sequence. Probably none of the cuts on the twins are longer than 40 seconds, maybe a minute at the most. I mean, that I don't think it's
not even
probably way under that.
Yeah, there were like 5 seconds, yeah.
Right, so knowing that, you're like, well, it's 5 seconds. I don't care. I meant that as the confines, not like he's going to put them at the top of Mordor or something, you know.
Okay. Well, now, look, we're going to come back and discuss some other stuff that people like Hydraulics and stuff did. I should point out Lola did 100-something shots. We talked about 20 of them, the other ones being much, much simpler and less dramatic, terms like split screens and stuff. But I must admit, Mark Christensen has said the B word. So, Mark?
What's the B word?
Breathing.
I did? Oh, I did. In a different context than Mike.
Yeah, but we you know, it's the elephant in the room.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I did, when I brought up the film, I did mention this little tempest in a teapot about the breath, which, or I must add, the Sixth Sense completely mastered a good decade ago.
But, so funny, because I had the same film. I absolutely had the same film I was going to bring up. Go on. Do explain what it is.
Titanic.
Well, okay, but go on to explain what it is we're referring to, because we're sounding a bit like inside baseball right now.
Oh, it is, you know, I don't like to do this, but I think the remark that's been going around online is that even members of the lay public, not any part of the visual effects Illuminati, are looking at these shots of cold breath in Cambridge and really kind of squirming at how wrong they are. And I found myself even looking away. I was looking at a different part of the frame when they were on.
Because okay, so does anyone not think these are the worst on-screen breaths we've seen in recent memory? Okay, dead silence. All right, so let me say this. Rather than just take cheap shots at it,
yeah,
let's say, what is it that's wrong about it? I mean, articulate, for me, I have my own opinions, but articulate what's wrong. Because if we've said anything before on this show, I think it's only valid to criticize if we can offer some reason why we can articulate that it's wrong. So why is it so bad?
I mean, when I am teaching compositing, I emphasize the need to look at reference and don't get a stereotype in your head of what you're trying to achieve. Those breaths were lacking a lot of detail that I went back and looked at The Sixth Sense to just remind myself.
I did exactly the same thing.
I was talking about, if you use practical, you know, they used real practical, I think maybe smoke puffs in Sixth Sense. Do you know how they did those?
Look, I don't. I literally last night did exactly what you did and go, where are some good smoke puffs? Sixth Sense, because right. of the, you know, it gets cold with the ghosts around. Went yeah, and looked at so them and went, oh my God, these are so much better. And then I didn't go any further. Does anyone know how
so
that
the real
done?
Ones, the real ones are articulated. The way they fade in and out has all this kind of unpredictability about it. You know, they might kind of fade out in the middle. They don't ever completely cover someone's mouth like a ghost.
They're vapor that is
dissipates quickly.
Dissipating, exactly, not smoke that's drifting away. But, okay, does anyone else have any articulated reasons as to why these were bad?
Yeah. I would say two things. Mark sort of touched on them. I would use the term particle geyser and additive blend mode.
Yeah.
Because it just looked like they were just sort of slapped in there. And like you said, Mark, there wasn't a lot of definition. Some of the, like when it started, I was like, oh, these aren't so bad. But then in the middle, there's one of the breaths where it looks like he did a huge bong hit and was just like, you know, like blasting out Old Faithful out of his mouth. So I was just like, it really kind of got me on that one. And then I think it's the next one right after that where it looks like the digital breath causes lips to get like white from like an ad mode or something.
I think the Sixth Sense ones were also ads. So I don't know that you can just blame one of the oldest compositing techniques in the world.
No, I'm just saying the way that it's not the ad per se. It's just, it just stood out as that. It didn't look like natural.
Yeah.
Kanan?
I think it suffers from the problem of as we've discussed, everything else in the film was so well done. It was well edited. It was well shot.
Criticism through praise, yes.
And then, well, I don't really know what else to say. I mean, I've seen B-movies with people who were, you know, had some sort of magical property that allowed them to breathe smoke, and it, you know, and these films were shot for $100,000 and the breath looked better. I mean, there's really no way to praise it. But
it can be
over the top.
Okay, but if we're sitting in a critique, if we're sitting in rushes, in dailies, what's our note to the guy that's done this?
Reference.
Yeah, that would definitely be the note. Is take a look at what this actually looks like, or have you ever been in a climate that was cold enough to see breath? Because it doesn't feel like it.
Or go home and put your head in the freezer and videotape it.
Okay. I think for me, I was trying to articulate this. It seems to me that what it felt like was somebody said, I want to see breath. And what we didn't get was somebody saying, at this angle, the light isn't backlighting it, so it wouldn't show up. At this angle, it would show up. And because a lot of that stuff, I mean, if I literally was trying to shoot smoke yesterday for something to do with deep compositing, and you know, we backlit it. We could only backlight it to get it to read on camera over black. And so if you're in front of someone's face, where it's not over black because their face is not black, and it's side lit or almost front lit as the actor, I think it was Zuckerberg's character, goes to camera right And then there's the camera comes around to do a straight-on shot of him from looking onto him, so he's leaning against the wall. But the light is at the back, they've just come out of. So the orientation being the door is at the back of shot in my head. And Zuckerberg comes out of that door, goes camera right, and then leans on that wall. And those shots felt like, well, I'm not going to read that. Even if they had cigarette smoke coming out of their mouth, I'm not going to read it because it's not backlit and it's over quite a light-coloured person. And so if you have to make it read in that environment, it's always going to look fake, no matter how what the source was. I think your other points are also valid.
Isn't it true that, I mean, you could light it to match that environment? If you did a proper element, you could light it.
But don't you feel like somebody said, I want to see smoke in these shots, or somebody took it upon themselves to say, we should see breath in these shots, and that wasn't tempered with, not all of them, obviously, only the ones where you'd get the light at the right angle and you'd kind of see it. And also, I think there was, if that was a criticism, my second one would be, did anyone feel like the volume of air matched the breathing of the actor? Because that was the other one. It sounded like there were some bits where you would sigh, which you'd expect to have that kind of, and other, there were short, sharp P's in the sentence, which don't produce that much air, and we were still getting the same kind of volume. Like, it seemed unmotivated and poorly lit, it would be my criticism.
So it could be a state of the industry question as to how did this happen, and we can only speculate. I mean, we know we've got a director and a team that's capable of recognizing things that look good, and we know that, I don't know what house did this, but we know it wasn't one of the principal ones. So I wonder, this seems like the kind of thing that happens when something's done last minute and shopped out to a boutique shop that maybe it's their first show.
I don't know who did it either, and I kind of frankly didn't want to find out because I didn't want to be naming them. But because we're not in the business of like trying to just shame somebody, we're just trying to say what did or didn't work and why. But it is, I don't think, the only way I can get around this is that Fincher deliberately left this in to give us something to talk about on the VFX show. There's just no universe that I live in that he liked that shot.
I would bet somebody gave the note, it doesn't feel cold enough out there.
Yeah.
Make it feel cold. And then the last reel came in with the,
Yeah, something like that. And they were like, okay. And just someone was like, fine, here you go. Blasted it over the top. And someone goes, oh, that's perfect.
And it just and what's really weird about it, too, is not only is it abhorrently bad, it made the trailer.
I know.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So that makes me feel like less like it may have been Fincher's choice and more like it might.
Yeah, I know, and I'd love to agree with you, but I can't believe that someone as good as David Fincher hasn't got Last Cut, you know?
Yeah, but how did it make the trailer?
I don't know.
Unbelievable that shot also, not just one of them,
I know.
Two of them.
You shouldn't, No.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Hey, let's change it completely because I don't want to finish on a down note and discuss the fact that Harvard, a magnificent university that it is, in its infinite wisdom decided to not let them film on campus. And so they had to basically create Harvard from not being on
campus. They started filming on campus in the beginning.
Did they?
At the very, very beginning they were filming. They started to film on and around the Harvard campus.
I thought they filmed out the front using like a street performer cart to generate artificial light so they could get it in the back of shot rather than actually being allowed to.
Yeah, and did tricks like film, park the sticks across the street and have a street performer go in with a practical light so they could get a little bit of
part of the background. But they actually were allowed on, were they? I didn't think they were.
The Wikipedia entry suggests that they filmed... Let's see, blah, 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 blah. Scenes were filmed around the campus in the beginning, and then Harvard changed their mind, and they were the scenes had to be moved to Phillips Academy and the Milton Academy. And then other scenes were filmed at Wheelock College, and then eventually they had to set up, the faux Harvard. So, according to Wikipedia.
Well, okay, so clearly a bunch of visual effects shots were devoted to things that were related to making it look like Harvard. Does anyone know Harvard? I mean, do any of us I certainly don't know Harvard to say that was or wasn't accurate, though obviously there were some fairly iconic Harvard aspects to it. Does it? But
I know Stanford and that house party, the verisimilitude of that was perfect. But at Harvard, I've only been there a couple times, and I mean, I think they certainly got the feel of it. You'd have to be a diehard to really locate yourself in those shots and say what they fudged. Yeah.
I don't know if it's entirely necessary for it to be 100% accurate to Harvard. It just had to, as Mark said, just had to feel like it was Harvard. And probably 99% of the people who'll see this movie will never set foot on the Harvard campus.
True. And yet you are dealing with something that was both factually involved in the story in real life and is very central to the story in the film.
Well,
so,
Mike, did you ask your wife?
No, I didn't, only because the film hasn't opened here yet, so I saw it at a press screening, so she hasn't seen it. But look, I guess for me that there were no window shots that I went, whoa, we're keying out a window. There were no set extensions or anything that I saw in the film that drew attention to the fact that they were quite significantly faking out Harvard. And obviously they made life difficult for themselves because there are quite a few traveling shots where they start at one part of Harvard and race back to the, you know, to the computers to do something or are going to lectures or doing whatever. So it wasn't like Harvard was a minor character in this. I mean, it was a pretty serious character.
Well, I'm also interested in the shot that could have been, which was during the titles. You know, they have the sequence of him walking outside. Yeah. Do you know a little bit about this? You know how Fincher doesn't do dolly, he doesn't do crane shots, and they were going to basically stitch together a series of dollies and try to make it one shot. And then I don't know why it was abandoned, but I'm sure it was something they tried in previs.
Yeah, it's interesting he doesn't like crane shots, isn't it? I love a good crane shot. Does anyone actually know
why? Well, it sounds like with this he was trying to create what would be a crane shot with a bunch of dollies.
Yeah. But I mean, you're right. Like, he doesn't. And does anyone know why he doesn't? Has he ever said publicly why he doesn't? Because it just feels like there's nothing like a crane shot for an establishing shot, especially during opening titles where you've got a bunch of screen time that normally has no dialogue under it and consequently is, you know, perfect for sort of sweeping shots. I mean, if it was ever... If I was the DP, God, you know, love it if I was, but if I was the DP and I walked into that meeting and I didn't know Fincher didn't do crane shots, that'd be the first thing I'd be suggesting, man. That would be, you know, it's like establishing shot production value 101. Like, you just don't get any better than that. So, I mean, I agree. I didn't think that shot, I didn't think that sequence hurt, but I knew what was coming because I'm such a Sorkin fan that I couldn't do what Kanan did and not read anything about it. And I knew that structurally from the script, it was a pivotal point that you would have this opening scene of him going back and starting the development that night, and then it would cut to him in the deposition saying, no, that didn't happen. And that was Sorkin's way of saying, well, this is recounting what happened and there are multiple versions of reality and I'm going to get that into it by jumping around in time, which I think worked splendidly well. But because I knew that was coming, I wanted to get through that opening walking through Harvard really quick because I knew that we just had screen time up there to get us people's names on the screen. I guess you guys didn't know that going in, so it didn't bug you?
No, it was fine for me. I was felt a little long, maybe. I was like, all right, I clearly he's going somewhere. Just get there. What was I going to say? Something about, I don't know. My brain just fell out of my head.
It does seem like this film overall had less of the camera calling attention to itself than other David Fincher films we could think of.
Right. That's what I was going to say. There's one, apparently they said in the ASC article, they weren't even sure that there may be one handheld shot in the whole film.
Isn't that incredible?
Dolly and sticks.
Yeah. Wow. The other thing we should draw attention to is that Light Iron Digital worked on this, or rather the colorist from that actually did the final grade on the Pablos at Red Studios, which is the old Desi Arnaz Studios in Hollywood, because the Red guys invited them to go on to Red Stage, the new ones they were owning, I think it was Stage 4 in Hollywood, to do the final grade. And And I think Lighteon Digital is coming. I've visited, and they're really good guys. They're really good. They do a lot of on-set and workflow stuff, and they really know Red really, really well. And
I was actually at Red two times during the grading of this film. I was on the stage there. Not obviously, I wasn't able to see any images, but the setup was impressive. I mean, they had Mike. You've been to that stage. They have a 20-by-40-foot screen with a 4K projector.
Yeah, they've got the Sony SRX, right?
Yeah, and Michael Cioni brought their Pablo. He's got it mobile. It's all racked up, and they had like a little stage in the middle with the Pablo and the Neo panel in the middle, and Ian Vertovic, their colorist, was just sitting at like the throne. You know what I mean? This is amazing. I don't think there's ever been a better color suite.
Yeah, I mean, Ian's a really good colorist, but I've got to say, Michael's also really good. I mean, I don't know if anyone heard his talk about moving from dailies to hourlies,
but yeah.
Michael's a guy that really gets it. I mean, he's slightly evangelical because I think he just can't help himself. But then who amongst us isn't, eh? I mean, he's really pushing hard on the digital workflow, and of course that's being fully enabled by Red. And I think those guys also, I'm speaking out of turn here, but I'm pretty sure those guys are also involved in Pirates 4. And the digital workflow on that as well, which was also shot on the Reds. So yeah, so I think the grade was good. I didn't find it lacking in dynamic range. I when I opened the thing, I actually thought the whole thing looked awesome, and I would have to say that I honestly believe this was like the A team from the DIT data point of view to the director. There was the A team on this, and they all kind of carried their weight from a color grading point of view just superbly well. I thought it looked really nice. And I've got to say, if you're in Harvard or a place like Harvard in winter with interior shots with people hanging out in kind of effectively, dorm kind of accommodation, there's not a lot of color. It's not, it's not autumn with the leaves. It's a pretty drab palette.
Actually, that's true. Maybe low dynamic range is not the way to describe it, my feeling on it. It's just, I've never, and it's also because Red has such a good, there's such a lot of information you can dig out of the image. Most footage you see is just blazingly popping and colorful and, these great contrast curves. And that's because they went so intentionally understated that it almost, or I guess I've seen so much Red footage that for me, it just right away, I was like, whoa, it's so like under the radar.
I mean, Kanan, what did you think of that, the grading on the nightclub sequence? Because that was very distinctive. You know, they've got the uplit from the table and stuff.
Man, that was fantastic. I'll tell you, that was one of those scenes, not just the grading. I mean, the entire scene, I felt like I was there. And I'm sure you felt that way too. The music's blaring. Everyone's yelling. The lights are going on. It felt in every single way imaginable. It felt like you were actually in... Well, yeah, just in the environment.
And weirdly, and I don't know how I could articulate this other than say it felt like the lighting was the right dating. If it had been poppier, I'd have expected the 80s. If it had been grungier, I'd have expected the 90s. It felt like the right nightclub light. Does anyone else know what I'm talking about here? It does, you know what I mean? Like clubs have this feel about them that were like there was a neon thing and there was the strobey kind of laser thing, and this felt right for the period. I mean, are we allowed to say it's a period film when it's only,
of course, 7 years is 7 years.
Well, not only that, the whole grade gave the film this coldness and alienation. Without it would be a great example if you wanted to see how to make a film feel cold and lonely without going into Matrix territory.
Yeah,
there wasn't a lot of green shadows in this one.
Yeah, this was not, dial up with the greatest respect. This wasn't colorista looks. This was actually graded. and I like colorista, don't get me wrong. I think it's great. We've actually standardized our workflow to it. But I'm just saying, like, it wasn't punched in. It was really nicely graded, I thought. Well, but at the end of the day, I mean, I just couldn't get past the fact. I just thought this was a terrifically written, very well acted, superbly executed piece of filmmaking, even notwithstanding some poppy breaths, which I think Kanan's pointed out is only bad because everything else was so bloody good. Any last thoughts?
Yeah, I wanted to say one brief thing here. I got two interesting pieces of trivia, perhaps three, but I'll make them very brief. It turns out that Harvard turned down the request for filming because in 1970, a movie called Love Story was filmed, and it did a massive amount of damage to the Harvard campus, up to and including, and here's the joke, the doorknob in the chancellor's office was actually broken off during that film. And so the joke with the Winklevoss doorknob setting it on, I think that was a kind of a Fincher's way of perhaps flipping them off a bit.
It has to be.
The initial scene where Zuckerberg and his girlfriend and they break up was 99 takes, by the way.
Wow.
And the Soderbergh script, which was something like 196 pages, was just enormous. Maybe it was 160.
So there's a Soderbergh script?
No, Sorkin.
Sorkin. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Sorkin.
Okay, yeah.
The Sorkin script. Sorry about that. Skype must have jumped. Was originally like 100 and... It was an enormous script. And the studio demanded that the movie runtime fall, not including credits and everything, fall within 2 hours. And so Fincher's edict to the entire team was, okay, everyone, we're not cutting a single page. This is perfect. Everyone speak faster.
Well, you know, I would read Aaron Sorkin's, you know, shopping list. I mean, wow, that's great that he did that because, yeah, I just, his writing is so good. And well, Jason, you said you thought it was really tight anyway, right? Hardly any, there were no, for a film that had to have had a lot of exposition, I can't remember a scene where I thought, exposition.
I couldn't find it really. I mean, I'm sure it's there, but it's so expertly hidden that it's unnecessary to find.
Okay, and before you get to your second piece of trivia, can I ask you for the debunking, whatever? I mean, when they were talking jargon, insert jargon here, did it hold for you, the jargon?
Oh, yeah. That was all my trivia. But, yeah, the jargon was spot on. I actually went to see it with a friend of mine who is a extremely knowledgeable computer person, and I went to see it a second time with that same person. And this guy, Justin, he's actually on the new Life Zero podcast. But both times we walked out and we just went, wow, how did they do it? They nailed the hacker culture. They nailed the scene where he has the people drinking. You know, he's like, okay, this happens, you drink. If this happens, every single aspect of that was exactly spot on. The original LiveJournal blogging that he was doing while he was drinking and creating FaceMash, it was accurate. It was extremely accurate.
So I'm really glad to think that, because obviously at the extent of my technical knowledge in this area, everything seemed to make sense. But I was just desperately hoping that they didn't do the, get to a certain point and then just throw in buzzwords that somebody's found lying around.
No, they didn't. And in fact, even down to, you'll get a kick out of this, even down to when he was entering in his journal back, when they were, when you did journal entries back then, he even, when he wanted to bold something, did the thing that you have to do, which is you have to put something in carats, with a B and a slash B that ended. Just unbelievable. I mean, like,
yeah, I like,
the detail. I'm sorry. Just got to call you on that one. Because to this day, when I write stories on FX Guide, that's how I bold something.
Right, so that's what I mean, though. Even down to that level of detail, I mean, that's
I liked I like how when he was doing his when he was writing that he would end with the page break caret. You know, like I thought that was. I mean, it's what you would do, and it just I thought it was nice they left it in all that.
That's a hell of a touch because you have all of these other films where you somehow magically you get like effing static on the computer monitor if something goes wrong, which just drives me bonkers, and in this film he's actually doing a page break. So
absolutely, it's worth saying too that films usually run into quicksand when they try to play out any drama using type on screens. Usually death.
It's not only death, but the other thing is they go to any tech and it normally falls in a heap, right? So
different problem.
But it's as if normally what happens is you get anywhere near this and people don't know how to handle it is what I'm guessing saying that they just don't handle it well and it doesn't feel real. And it's I think it's really a shame because it's a kind of a I don't know if it's a a love note to the audience almost to get it right, you know? Like, it doesn't have to be right. If the number of people that could work out how accurate that was were in a room, they'd all be friends of Kanan's and plus a couple, you know what I mean? Like, I just think that there aren't that many people, but yet if you go to the trouble to get it right for all those people, then that's a great thing to be doing. And I guess you're right in the other extent. If you try putting it on screen that somebody's typing, it just becomes boring cinema. Which is your point, right?
Yeah.
Mark, is that right?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
I think if somebody wants to reference a good example of doing it, instead of going into interior narrative or all the monologue, all the other things you can do to get around this, you could look at this film as a way to do it dynamically.
And I guess the other thing is, I was a little nervous when I heard about this film back in the day that Facebook would sort of stop them from even using the logo. And so it would all be The Social Network, where The Social Network was key for Facebook. But everything down to the what seemed to be the banner mastheads all seemed to be, completely violating somebody's copyright.
Didn't this whole film seem to be like, go ahead, sue us for character defamation and stealing your copyright?
You think so?
Well,
I don't even know what the rights are on that. Can you?
Well, no, I think, but at a more fundamental level, is it flattering to Mark Zuckerberg, this movie? Like, I think if he really
but does
wasn't
it need
used,
to be, that's the question. Do people need to like Mark Zuckerberg for Facebook to be famous or popular at this point? I don't think so.
Well, no, but you have to believe if this was done, if this kind of treatment was done to a few other Silicon Valley heads we could think of, there might be a call from a legal department.
Yeah, but they weren't like 20 at the time when you're portraying them as, you know, whatever, however you would characterize them as being portrayed. I mean, most
well,
people
not that
were
much
kind
now.
No, but I'm just saying he wasn't a billionaire either. He was just a college kid.
But he took the whole Facebook team, didn't he, to a screening? I mean, I'm sure I saw that on Google. That you know,
he didn't take them. He actually refuses to see it.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, he actually said that he wishes people would wait until he was dead to make a movie about him. Which I thought was kind of a funny statement. I think the irony of this is it actually does not portray him in that negative a light. I mean, you know, he's a kid who did some things, sure, like we all did. The people that I think look really horrible in this film are the Winklevi. And the big irony there is that those guys actually loved the film. And I think you probably know this, went to a couple screenings at the – I forget who they're friends with. But they met someone on the film and got to know them and actually went to some screenings and have said, this is a great film. And then Eduardo Saverin, I think that's how you pronounce the last name, he was a consultant on the film and on the book.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, I don't think anyone comes out of this film looking really, really good, apart from the lawyer at the end who,
Legal assistant.
Legal assistant, I'm sorry. I apologize enormously, but yeah. But apart from that, I think almost everybody else in the film came out looking pretty bad. I don't think anyone is. But having said that, as somebody said, I kind of cared about what happened to nearly all of them. So, wow. How is that possible? Okay, well, look, that's it for this week. Let's just do a quick ring around where people can track you guys down. So starting with you, Mark.
Flowseeker on Twitter. I also want to promote not only that the new edition of my book, After Effects Studio Techniques, is out to tell you all about how to do visual effects in that application, but that, God bless him, David Fincher likes to keep control of his movies, keep things close. He's used to working with previs teams. In this case, he had a guy conform this whole movie in After Effects, and they slipped in a lot of things that might have been in the realm of VFX, and a lot of what was praised about the tightness and crispness of the dialogue was cheated by slicing up a scene and pushing action lines of dialogue together. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And
it was the assistant editor.
Correct. Kudos to him and to David Fincher for working that way, because that's how you get... This film was in the Neverland of a $50 million budget, which is supposedly not a sum you can use to make a movie, but...
I think he's proven otherwise. And Jason, where can people find you or your twin?
I'm on the Twitters as Jason Diamond, one word. You can find my brother as Josh underscore Diamond, because there's apparently other Josh Diamonds. I did actually friend another Jason Diamond who lives in Brooklyn, which is funny. And my our company's website, mbsproductions.com.
And Canon, I think you already mentioned the Life Zero, but just give us the where can people find you?
Oh, no, that's it, lifezero.org.
Obviously, I'm over at FX Guide and on Twitter as Mike Seymour. I want to thank Todd Shilton, our producer, and Matt Graham, our other producer, for putting the show together. We totally rely on these guys to do stuff, and I certainly made their life more difficult this week with jumping the schedule around a lot so we could bring you this discussion today a little earlier than we otherwise would, because I really thought it was worth it. And I want to thank you guys for being on the show, because it's been terrific talking with you. And also thank you guys, the audience, for listening, because, quite frankly, I really love how we get feedback from you guys. If you ever have any suggestions for shows and stuff, I know the retro shows are really popular, but we also like to do new films and stuff. Please keep firing them in. It's a very open forum. We do it because we get the feedback. It's the oxygen by which the show lives on. And that's it. I'll talk to you guys next week. And again, thank you so much for being with us. Until then, see you.